did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black so-and-so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, urged Saudi Arabia to immediately end its war on Yemen and lift its blockade on its southern neighbor. Said Nasrallah called on Saudi Arabia not to waste time by proposing deceiving initiatives which lead to nowhere, and stressed that stopping the war and the blockade should be simultaneous. Nasrallah also warned of a Saudi plot to blame Yemen's Ansar Allah movement for the ongoing conflict in the war-torn country.
You need to stop the war and end the blockade. Then we can sit and negotiate. Here's where the deception lies. What does it mean if you stop the war without ending the blockade? It means that what they could not realize through a military war, they want to achieve through humanitarian and social pressure.
Elsewhere in his remarks, he said the U.S. is not as strong as before and is on a path toward collapse, while the axis of resistance is gaining power.
America is no longer the America that you knew. There is one main issue that Imam Khamenei has stressed in the last year, and I call on everyone in the region to ponder on that thought. That is the decline of the U.S. America is taking the downward path.
Speaking at an event commemorating late Sheikh Ahmad al-Zin, who was a pioneer in clerics who spoke for Palestine, Nasrallah stressed that the so-called deal of the century has died as a result of the Palestinian people's patience. Observers believe Sayyid Nasrallah's views shows that there is an opportunity for the entire region, even for the Saudis, to be able to stop the crisis of the war they launched on Yemen.
The speech of Sayyid Hassan shows that all regional sides enjoy an opportunity to hold on to their principles and at the same time preserve their achievements. This is true even with the issue of Islamic Republic of Iran and its nuclear program. All of these developments can pave the way for achieving political results.
Hezbollah leader also warned regional countries against relying on the United States. Hezbollah's leader then touched upon the political impasse in Lebanon, calling for the immediate formation of a new government. Hezbollah's Secretary General has stressed in his speech that most of the wars in the region, namely in Syria or Yemen, are mainly aimed to target the resistance and the Palestinian cause and to create a Sunni-Shia rift. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Work crews were pumping millions of gallons of contaminated wastewater into an ecologically sensitive Florida bay on Sunday, 4th of April, as they tried to prevent the imminent collapse of a storage reservoir at an old phosphate mine. Officials in Manatee County, Florida, extended an evacuation zone overnight and warned that up to 340 million gallons could engulf the area in a 20-foot wall of water if they could not repair the breach at the Piney Point Reservoir in the Tampa Bay area of Florida, north of Bradenton. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe, with the Associated Press contributing. The piece is titled, Florida Faces Imminent Pollution Catastrophe from Phosphate Mine Pond. Stay with us for more of Richard Luscombe's article. Work crews were pumping millions of gallons of contaminated wastewater into an ecologically sensitive Florida bay on Sunday, 4th of April, as they tried to prevent the imminent collapse of a storage reservoir at an old phosphate mine, the old Piney Point phosphate mine in Bradenton, Florida. Officials in Manatee County extended an evacuation zone overnight and warned that up to 340 million gallons of contaminated water could engulf the area in a 20-foot wall of water if they could not repair the breach at the Piney Point Reservoir in the Tampa Bay area, north of Bradenton, Florida. Aerial images aired on local television showed water pouring from leaks in the walls of the retention pond. Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, declared a state of emergency after officials warned of the imminent collapse of the pond. He toured the scene by helicopter on Sunday and said at a press conference engineers were still attempting to plug breaches in the reservoir wall with rocks and other materials, and that other mitigation efforts included the controlled release of 35 million gallons daily at Port Manatee. He said the state's Department of Environmental Protection, DEP, had brought in 20 new pumps. What we're looking at now is trying to prevent and respond to, if need be, a real catastrophic flood situation, Ron DeSantis said. He added, the water quality issues that are flowing from this for us is less than the risk of everyone's health and safety, particularly folks who may live in the area. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis also attempted to downplay reports that the water contained traces of radioactive materials. The water was tested prior to discharge, and the primary concern is nutrients, Ron DeSantis said. He added, the water meets water quality standards, standards for marine waters, with the exception primarily of the phosphorus and the nitrogen. Scott Hopes, the acting county administrator, warned that despite a low population density, the nearby area could be overwhelmed by a sudden collapse of the 77-acre pond, even though discharges had lessened the quantity of remaining water. What if we should have a full breach? We're down to about 340 million gallons that could breach in totality in a period of minutes. And the models for less than an hour are as high as a 20-foot wall of water. So if you're in an evacuation area and you have not heeded that, you need to think twice and follow the orders. Officials widened the evacuation zone late on Saturday, 3rd of April, from a dozen or so properties to more than 300 houses. The Tampa Bay Times interviewed some residents of the area who were refusing to leave. A local jail just a mile away from the leaky pond was not being evacuated, but officials were moving people and staff to the second story and putting sandbags on the ground floor. Hope said models showed the area could be covered with between 1 foot and 5 feet of water, and the second floor is 10 feet above the ground. County officials said well water remained unaffected, and there was no threat to Lake Manatee, the area's primary source of drinking water. The pond at the abandoned phosphate mine at Piney Point in Bradenton, Florida, sits in a stack of phosphogypsum, a radioactive waste product from fertilizer manufacturing. The pond contains small amounts of naturally occurring radium and uranium. The stacks can also release large concentrations of radon gas, a radioactive gas. Nikki Fry, the Florida Agriculture Commissioner and the only elected Democrat in statewide office, warned of an environmental catastrophe and called on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who described the toxic water as mixed salt water, in a tweet announcing the state of emergency, to hold an emergency cabinet meeting. Floridans were evacuated from their homes on Easter weekend. 480 million gallons of toxic wastewater could end up in Tampa Bay. This might become an environmental catastrophe, Nikki Fry said on Twitter. Environmental protection groups warned that more pollutants in Tampa Bay would heighten the risk to wildlife from toxic red tide algae blooms. Phosphate companies have had over 50 years to figure out a way to dispose of the radioactive gypsum waste, the activist group Minnesota 88 said. At the present time, there are no federal, state, or local regulations requiring the industry to make final disposition of phosphogypsum waste in an environmentally acceptable manner. In a statement, the group, Minnesota 88, added, "The current crisis can be traced back to the absurd 2006 decision to allow dredge material from Port Manatee to be placed into one of the gypsum stacks at Piney Point, something the stack was never designed for and should have never been allowed." At the Sunday press conference, Scott Hopes, the county administrator, said the long-term objective would be to entirely pump out the three reservoirs on the site and fill them in. Later in the day, he said the amount of water left in the reservoir was now below 300 million gallons. The county commission said it was more comfortable than it had been, though a catastrophic collapse was still a possibility. Scott Hopes, the county administrator, also said this could have been resolved over two decades ago. The owner of Piney Point, HRK Holdings, bought the site after it was abandoned by Mulberry Corporation, which operated the phosphate plant for more than 40 years. As long ago as 2003, the Sarasota Herald Tribune reported reservoir walls were crumbling. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, previously authorized the dumping of hundreds of millions of gallons of toxic water into the Gulf of Mexico. At a meeting of the Manatee Commission on Thursday, called after the seriousness of the new leak became apparent, engineers pointed to the deterioration of the pond's decades-old plastic liner. "The condition of the plastic liner is not particularly great," Mike Kelly, an engineer commissioned by HIK Holdings, told the meeting. The Times reported, "It's old, there were some installation issues, there's a long-documented history of that liner system having issues." The newspaper inspected records and found that staff documented small holes or weaknesses in plastic seams above the waterline back in July, October, and December of 2020. On Sunday, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis said HIK Holdings would be held accountable if a disaster occurs in Manatee County.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Witness Donald Williams says he made a 911 call to police to report the police because he believed that he had witnessed a murder. This is from one of the eyewitnesses to the killing of George Floyd, the African-American man killed in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, last year. Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 25 seconds while the victim kept saying, "I can't breathe." The Chauvin trial is currently taking place, and Floyd's family is hoping the former policeman will be convicted, but other families whose loved ones have been killed by police in the U.S. say even with a video, there is no guarantee that a white cop will be convicted of murdering a black man. Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
The murder trial of Derek Chauvin, a former American cop who knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for about 9 minutes in Minneapolis last May. Chauvin is charged with the death of that arrested man, George Floyd. The first week of the trial was marked by dramatic and emotional accounts. An eyewitness broke down in tears while responding to prosecutors.
"I heard him keep trying to asked him to let him up so he can't breathe. And even I said to the officer, I said, man, he said he can't breathe. His money said, well, if he keep talking, he can breathe.
Floyd's partner of nearly 3 years also got very emotional while testifying. One of the key moments of the trial was on the fifth day of the proceedings. That's when a senior homicide investigator called Chauvin's use of force on Floyd totally unnecessary.
First of all, pulling him down to the ground face down and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill him.
Many Americans also say Floyd's death has had profound emotional and psychological consequences for them.
It's very traumatic for a black person to follow a trial of a black person who was innocently murdered.
I think it's opened a lot of people's minds to be on the lookout for discrimination.
And so I think that a lot of people, or maybe of my color, have been suffering from that sort of PTSD and trauma.
We also have to have that conversation of what is the role of the police.
One can say that what unites all these people is the trauma of watching the death of a black man under the knee of a white police officer. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyers argue that Floyd died due to drug overdose. That's why medical examiners have said his death was homicide at the hands of police. The case of George Floyd is undoubtedly a clear example of police injustice and brutality in the United States. His death has already become a symbol of a rallying cry for a global movement against systemic racism and discrimination. But how many other victims are needed for U.S. police to stop abusing their power, especially against minorities in a country known for its racial diversity?
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, founder of Uhuru Movement, Omaili Yeshitala, out of St. Petersburg, Florida, and writer and social justice activist Yandi Ndeko, out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in St. Petersburg. And Omaili, black Americans are 1.5 times more, 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than whites, and police officers are less likely to be indicted for killing a black person as opposed to others. What exactly does this mean?
It means several things. One thing that it means for sure is that African States constitute a domestic colony, and that Africans in the United States are treated just like colonized people are treated globally. All over the world, you see the same kind of thing, so that even though you may have a particular law that they claim is applicable to everybody equally, the fact is that the colonizer and the colonized have a different relationship to laws that have been created by the colonizer for the purpose of upholding colonialism. And that's why you can see the difference in the number and the percentage of African people, the police, as compared to white people who are the settler colonizers inside the United States. The same would hold true in Israel with Palestinians and with the Israeli citizens. And all over the world, you see a similar kind of thing. That's what we're looking at in the United States.
Well, Yane, it appears that when there is a black victim of police violence, there's immediate demonization of the victim, not the accused murderer. Do you agree or not with that? And if so, why is it the case?
Definitely, I agree with that. You can see examples of that. Even when you look at the recent murder that there was a white man that murdered a bunch of individuals, that in a Chinese hate situation, it's as it relates to what Brother Omaili spoke about as the difference between how the colonizers, those who represent the colonizers, are treated compared to those who are amongst part of the colonized communities, that individual was extended a lot of grace. You know, they said he was having a bad day. There was a lot of passion, all this recognition of his humanity. Whereas whenever it's a black victim, the first thing that people attempt to do, and that was with the person who actually was not even a victim, but actually murdered people. But when you're dealing with a black victim, a person who is murdered by the police, one of the first things that they seek to do is find anything they can in order to undermine the character of that individual. And that's ultimately in order to give the both individuals who relate to the state, and particularly within the white community, who play a role of actually like of interceders between the rest of the oppressed class and the colonizing ruling class, those individuals need excuses in order to be able to continue to stand up for an unjust environment like the militarizing of our communities and the roles that the police play. And so they give them excuses in order to be able to say, see, it was okay. This person was a bad person, and it's not the police aren't bad. The police are victims because they're not being understood as individuals who are having to go up against these really terrible individuals, these terrible entities, even though these are unarmed people, these are people who are not posing any threats. And regardless of whatever happened in their background, they weren't on trial, and it is not the police's right to execute them.
Well, Omali, if we're talking about the U.S., a country that has been built on systemic racism, should there be expectations that justice can be served via the court system?
I think, generally speaking, you cannot achieve justice. The colonized cannot achieve justice through the colonial system. And I think the great fear that the United States is confronted with right now is that, particularly as a consequence of this particular trial, where there and the case of the murder of George Floyd, where millions of people, African people as well as the world, were able to see that murder happen and to collectivize it and to hear the testimony, where every African who listened to another African talk about how helpless they felt and how shame and guilty they feel because they didn't do something, I think there's a growing consciousness among the African population that would take us back to that place where African people had come to understand that the enemy is colonialism and that we cannot achieve any kind of justice under this foreign alien domination of our people, and that we have to fight for power over our own lives. This is the thing that led to J. Edgar Hoover, who has come to be the notorious head of the domestic political police in the United States, called the FBI. This is what led him to say that the struggle for black power in the United States, as represented by the Black Panther Party, was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. That is because they recognized that this whole rotten social system that murders and brutalizes people all around the world does the same thing in the communities here inside the United States, and that once this people stand up, the whole system stands to be crushed. And I think that's what we're going to see more and more. And I think especially after this trial, where each of us had an opportunity to experience the murder of George Floyd as something that, if given an opportunity, we should have done something, would have done something, want to do something, I think you're going to see more direct participation by African people to stop it and to turn it over. That's the struggle against colonialism. That's where we will find our justice.
Well, Yane, we saw mass demonstrations last year across the country after George Floyd's murder. What has happened since then? Has the situation improved for African Americans?
Well, the situation, as is suggested by Chairman O'Malley, the situation is not going to improve for people of African descent here or anywhere in the world until the system is upended. Actually, another example of injustice is Brother Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who is incarcerated for a crime that he did not commit. And he wrote a book called Murder Incorporated, and in that book he wrote about the white republic, and he talks about the fact that from the beginning, with the first congressional act of the nation, the Naturalization Act of 1790, it limited nationalization to all free white people, to all free white persons. And so even at that time, and this is the core upon which this nation has been built, that this settler nation has been built, that this has always been a situation where the laws are applied differently depending on who it is that the subject is. So people of African descent are at times he's able to find individual pieces of justice because there's an effort to sow confusion amongst the various oppressed communities here. But ultimately, nothing about these laws are intended to be the benefit of any working class people of any race. And so the only way that those who are considered the primary target, the base of the oppression hierarchy, which are black people, are going to find justice is by upending the entire system and living under our own rule and having self-determination.
Well, Amali, the mother of Eric Garner, who was killed by police in New York, while he, too, was saying he could not breathe, has said that even with the video showing the murder of a black person, it does not equate to the murderer being convicted. Your take on that, and if that happens to be the case this time around, that the former police officer is not convicted, how do you think that that is going to affect? Will we see mass demonstrations again or even more?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with the assumptions that were made by Mother Eric Garner's mother that there is no guarantee, even with video and what have you. And also with the statement that was made by Sister Yanni that the fact is that it's quite possible that given the severity of the condemnation, the how wide the witness of George Floyd's murder, the fact that within 3 months after his murder, there was something like 10,000 demonstrations, protests, and even uprisings in the United States, and more than 60 countries around the United States, we saw people protesting his murder, all of whom are responding to a reality not only of George Floyd, but also of the fact that the whole world lives under a form of colonial domination by U.S. and European imperialism and are fighting against that. So it's a possibility. That the U.S. government, the state itself, in a way to obscure its responsibility for the colonial domination of African people, will throw George with Derek Chauvin to the wolves. That's some possibility. If they need it, they'll do it in order to obscure the relationship that the state has. That's why you even hear local media, ruling class media here, talk about Chauvin being a former police officer. He wasn't a former police officer when he killed him. He murdered George Floyd as an arm of a domestic colonial state apparatus. And so if necessary to obscure, to protect the state and the colonial relationship that they have, they would definitely allow for and create the conditions for Derek Chauvin to go to trial. And yes, I do anticipate more demonstrations, but I'm telling you that regardless of what the outcome of is in this trial, the situation has changed. Because as opposed to those circumstances where separate and individual communities experience the death and the murder, which happens every day, it's ubiquitous. What happened to George Floyd is not unusual. What's unusual is the masses of people around the world. People had an opportunity. I guarantee what the outcome of this trial.
Stay with me, Amali. Stay with me. I want to get back to that at the end, but let me cross back over to Yannette. Now, there are so many situations and circumstances that black people have been killed by police, it is said, from being black while playing at the park to being black while shopping at Walmart to being black while changing lanes while driving can all end up fatally, as it has for some victims. Explain what this means, especially for our viewers that are less familiar with the reality on the ground in the United States.
What it ultimately means is that as a black person within the United States, you cannot walk around in your life and feel that you are ever safe. You can be sleeping in your bed next to your boyfriend, who then protects you because somebody is breaking into your home and you can be murdered. You can be sleeping on your sofa, and that was the case of Breonna Taylor. You can be sleeping on your sofa in your grandmother's house at 7 years old and have somebody bust into your house and blow your brains out of your head, which is the case of what happened with Ayanna Stanley Jones. And so there is no ability for a person to walk through and to feel like there's some special thing that you can do. A lot of times people will say, well, you should have just listened to the officer. You should have cooperated. And, you know, and it doesn't really matter what you do. There's actually been video of a person. There was a video of a person who was being confronted with police, and they were giving him every the most impossible collection of orders. And this man had to be completely afraid that he was going to be murdered, because there's nothing you can do if you are of African descent being confronted by police in order to guarantee your safety. And it doesn't matter who you are if you are in black skin. And so that is what it means why we say things like driving while black, or, you know, shopping while black, because your blackness, it overshadows your humanity in the context of this colonial settler state, this white republic, in which the laws and all of the agents who are, all of the individuals who act as agents of the law are protected in order to move it against, you know, move things in the best interest of the ruling class and uphold the status quo.
Oh, Miley, what does all this mean? You've heard what our other guest has just said, and you said that this time around you think it's different. Where is it all going in the United States? Where is this situation going?
I think the depth of crisis inside the United States cannot be overstated. I think the crisis of the entire imperialist social system that's murdering and brutalizing people around the world are concentrated in the United States, which is the shaky hegemon of the whole global colonial capitalist system. I think what we're heading for, with little doubt in my mind, I mean, you look at what's happening on January 6th, the sector of the settler colonists themselves attack the capital of the government of the United States, and then African people, 10,000 uprisings and protests and demonstrations in 3 month period subsequent to the murder of George Floyd inside the United States itself. I think this trial will result in growing numbers of African people reaching revolutionary conclusions, going back to the place where we had achieved revolutionary conclusions before the United States government unleashed a reign of terror that assassinated our leaders and arrested so many people, put in place a prison regime that has resulted in one out of every eight human beings on earth being in prison, being an African in the United States. I think we're going to see the revolution return full flesh in the United States. And this particular incident with George Floyd is going to prove to be a contributor to that turning point that we're talking about.
Right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this debate. Founder Uhuru Movement, Omani Yeshitala, out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Writer and social justice activist, Yane Ndeko, out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing up for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. The harassing policies that Israeli regime applies against newly freed Palestinian prisoners vary according to the prisoners' home regions and positions. In the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank, prisoners are sometimes released at dawn or midnight to ensure families and friends cannot immediately greet and celebrate with the newly freed Palestinians. We'll prepare for you an article written by Wafa al-Udaini, a Palestinian journalist based in the Gaza Strip, under the heading, Israeli Occupation Authorities Ban Celebration for New Freed Palestinian Detainees. Please stay with us for more of Wafa al-Udaini's article. The Day of Freedom from Prison is a special day for Palestinian political prisoners and their families. It is considered a national day where celebrations are held and fireworks launched. Yet, according to Israeli laws against Palestinians, freed prisoners of Al-Quds are not allowed to hold any kind of celebration, whether in their neighborhood or in their own homes. Furthermore, freed prisoners are often rearrested by the occupation police to sign pledges to not hold any celebrations, ceremonies, and even not to raise the Palestinian flag. They are also not allowed to receive guests who wish to congratulate them on their release from prison. On Tuesday, 30th of March, the Zionist regime's occupation forces stormed the home of Majd Barbar, former Palestinian political prisoner released after 20 years of detention, one day earlier. They kidnapped him and attacked family members and friends who were present in his home in the Ra'as al-Amud neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. Majd al-Barbar was released again after one day of detention, but under several conditions, including pledging not to hold celebration events, not to raise the Palestinian flag, not launching fireworks, and to pay a financial guarantee of 1,000 shekels. Majd Barbar is a father of two and has been detained by the Israeli occupation forces since 2001. On the day of his release from prison, his family, friends and neighbors of his Al-Quds neighborhood welcomed him grandly. Several touching videos of this welcoming back reunion featured Majd Barbar with his loved ones went viral on social media sites. Zaina, 20-year-old daughter of Majd Barbar, said, "The occupation always tries to snatch any joy and happiness from our hearts. It's really unfair. The moment of my father's freedom is so significant in our lives. Israel took him away from me since I was 15 days old." Ali al-Maghrabi, a spokesperson for the Asra Information Office, said this is a familiar pattern with Palestinian political prisoners held in Israeli military prisons. Al-Maghrabi stated, "When they end their sentence, they are rearrested. This Israeli policy is mostly used in occupied Al-Quds. Some former prisoners have been forcibly deported from their hometown for days, whilst others have been prohibited from celebrating or participating in any political or peaceful events." He added, "The occupation aims at keeping Palestinians of Al-Quds in states of pain, frustration and sadness. It doesn't want them to connect with their Palestinian identity." For Al-Quds former prisoners, the Israeli authorities re-detained many of them as they walked out of prison after serving long years. Amjad Abu Asab, head of the Committee of Families of Prisoners from Al-Quds, said, "They were kidnapped and re-detained by Zionist regime forces and then re-released under restricted conditions by signing pledges to not celebrate or participate in any political or peaceful event." Ali al-Maghrabi stated in an interview, "Such celebrations are considered as one of the popular resistance methods, so the occupation tries to stop them and kill any spirit of resistance or patriotism. The total number of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons today is nearly 5,000, of whom 450 remain in administrative detention. Over 500 Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, are from Al-Quds alone. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, the Israelis followed this policy in order to keep Palestinians in occupied Al-Quds oppressed and disappointed so that no one can see the prisoner as a hero. Ali Al-Mughrabi, the spokesman for ASRA Information Office, explained, "The Israeli policy of no celebration is nothing new. All the Israeli policies used against the prisoners are totally racist. They want to bury the Palestinian identity from the residents of Al-Quds to show that the old city is completely Jewish." He added that this policy is not implemented on the Israelis. The Israelis also use another policy to oppress and harass newly freed Palestinian prisoners of Al-Quds by deporting them to another city. Such a gross injustice happened to Wasim Al-Jalad a year ago. Wasim Al-Jalad, a 42-year-old Palestinian from Al-Quds, was re-detained and transferred to Al-Muskabiyah police station immediately after he had been freed from a 15-year prison sentence. Wasim Al-Jalad was a new groom when he was arrested by the Israeli occupation forces. While the latter raided his home to rearrest him, he was holding his wedding ceremony and they dragged him this way out of his home. He was accused of participating in anti-occupation military operations. His family planned to hold his wedding ceremony again after finishing his prison sentence, but the Israeli authorities forced him to cancel his wedding ceremonies and not to celebrate his release, nor to attend any gatherings as a condition of his re-release. They also deported him from Al-Quds for 2 weeks and compelled him to pay a financial guarantee of $1,400 and another unpaid amount of $25,000. He was released one day after the expected day on July 2019. His mother said in pain that they waited for this day. The harassing policies that Israel applies against newly freed Palestinian prisoners vary according to the prisoners' home regions and positions. Since the Israeli occupation forces fully control the occupied city of Al-Quds, they have completely banned celebration there. In the Gaza Strip and in the occupied West Bank, prisoners are sometimes released at dawn or midnight to ensure families and friends cannot immediately greet and celebrate with the newly freed Palestinians. In cases where the detention of Palestinian political prisoners had grabbed media attention, like for teenager Ahed Tamimi, long hunger striker Khaled Adnan, and journalist Mohammed Al-Qiq, the Israeli authorities apply yet again different post-release policies. Several human rights organizations demand that Israel stops these sadistic and harassing policies of freed Palestinian political prisoners. Moreover, more than 550 international human rights organizations have jointly called upon the United Nations Human Rights Council to recognize and denounce the Israeli regime's racist policies against the entire Palestinian population, which include home demolitions and violation of the right of Palestinians to self-determination. The organizations, in a letter published recently, urged the United Nations to form an independent fact-finding mission and investigate the Tel Aviv regime's colonial and apartheid practices, in addition to its associated systematic policies. They stress that Israel's culture of impunity has further allowed business enterprises to benefit from the prolonged Israeli occupation and the perpetration of gross human rights violations against Palestinians. The signatories urged the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to further develop, in a transparent manner, the United Nations database on business enterprises involved in Israel's illegal settlement expansion activities. They also called on the international community to utilize all available mechanisms to obtain justice and accountability for the Palestinians, to intervene immediately and slap economic sanctions against the Israeli regime, and hold individuals who may have committed war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories to account. The human rights organizations finally urged member states of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to publicly support and fully cooperate with the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to ensure the arrest and trial of individuals investigated and found guilty of international crimes at The Hague, and prevent the continued perpetration of crimes against Palestinians. The Israeli regime has received a letter from the International Criminal Court, ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands, formally detailing the scope of its war crimes investigation in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Israeli Channel 13 television network said the letter was sent recently and has requested the Tel Aviv regime to respond to it within 30 days. The report added that Israel's so-called National Security Council has already met to formulate an official response. It noted that the letter covers three main topics: the 2014 Israeli military onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip, Israeli settlement policy in the occupied territories, and the 2018 Great March of Return protests in the Gaza Strip along the fence separating the territory from the occupied lands that led to Israel's martyring of dozens of innocent Palestinians. Earlier this month, the International Criminal Court, the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, announced in a statement the launch of war crimes investigation into the Palestinian territories, which have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. Fatou Bensouda said her inquiry will be conducted independently, impartially, and objectively, without fear or favor. The Palestinian Authority welcomed the ICC prosecutor's announcement. The Palestinian Authority Foreign Ministry said in a statement, "It is a long-awaited step that serves Palestinians' tireless pursuit of justice and accountability, which are indispensable pillars of the peace the Palestinian people seek and deserve." The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, also praised the International Criminal Court, ICC's move.